Hi, everybody. My name is Vivian, and I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. And it's really an honor and a privilege, even though I get so nervous I could just spit. But I know that this is, you know, what keeps me sober, and it's all of you, and it's rooms like these and people like you that keeps me sober today, and for that I'm truly and eternally grateful. I'll never be able to pay back what Alcoholics Anonymous has given to me. And I have a life today second to none because of what the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, people like you and Trish and Polly and all these beautiful people and all these wonderful faces, especially the ones Nita and Bray and all you guys, Cheryl, Donna, I could just name the whole room out, you know. And I tell you, it just fills me up. And I heard a lady not too long ago said that her cup was filled and she was drinking from the saucer. And you know, and that's how I feel today. And I'm sure I'm going to get real emotional, so y'all just bear with me. But thank you, and I love you all. And it's so very special because I was, you know, we went down this morning and had that beautiful, you know, meditation down by the river, and it was just so beautiful. And I want to thank Betsy, wherever she is, because she did such a beautiful job. And, you know, and I'm sitting there, and I came back, and we had this breakfast, and I noticed the ladybugs, and I got this overwhelming presence of my daughter, and as I've had all weekend, and I went, you know, just look what you've done for us and for me. And it's just so special. And to be able to be up here and to be a part of something that has grown from this, from that little story and what's come of it and how it keeps the memory of my daughter so alive and so very special. Because for so long it was so dead. And it's because of this program that I can share, get up here and do this. Because it's certainly not anything in my design to be standing here, because I would be running up that door. And anyway, let me get on with it. I really appreciate it, Polly. It's an honor. When I crawled through these doors, or stumbled in, actually, in the Alcoholics Anonymous, January 3rd, 1990, you know, I really don't know. It was just nothing short of the grace of God that got me in the rooms. There was a lady who had come to work in my shop, who I haven't had anyone work in my shop for years and years and years. And she introduced me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll tell you a little bit about that, but I'd like to back up and tell you a little bit about my history and about my family and where I'm from. I was born in Columbia, South Carolina. And my mom had moved from New York City as a result of a very rageful and chronic alcoholic, physically abused my mom. I had no recollection of my father ever, and all I ever knew about him is I never wanted to be anything like him. And I grew up with a tremendous resentment towards him and everything he stood for. And you know, and inevitably, I became all those things that I despised in him. I became all those things that he was. And I grew up in Columbia, South Carolina. I was born with a physical handicap, and I was in and out of the hospitals, more in the hospitals for the first 9 years of my life. And at the very tender age of 6 weeks old, they introduced me to a drug called Paragaric. And I don't know if you know what's in there, but it's heroin and alcohol. So I feel like my drinking started at a very tender age, and that was really the only thing they could give me for whatever was wrong with me at the time. And they really didn't know what was wrong with me in those days. X-ray technology was just coming on the scene, and they really didn't know. I was dehydrating. I was chronically in a lot of pain, and I had to be fed intravenously, so I was literally in the hospital most of those 9 years. I was given the last rites on several occasions. So a familiarity with death and dying was a common thing in my life at that point. And so I learned to live with a high level of pain most of my life in those years. At 9 years of age, I was laying in the hospital one more time receiving the last rites. And I remember waking up and seeing this room full of all of my family members standing around me, and they were praying for me. And there was a priest there again, and I remember seeing this white light. And I don't remember anything after that, but shortly thereafter, I was able to go back home. And I know that was one of the first miracles that occurred in my life. And I went back home, and I was able to resume a semi-normal life at that time because I didn't have one up to then. And quite frankly, I've never had one. I don't know what it is. It's still foreign to me. But I went on to school, and I was able to maintain somewhat of a normal physical life. And I had severe stomach problems. I was finally diagnosed with ulcers at the age of 10. And I was treated for that throughout my life, but I was giving all kinds of drugs during that time. And Paragard was just a mainstay. The doses, of course, became more increasing and larger amounts and stuff, and then they'd periodically take me off of it, and we know what that does today. And I don't know how my mom lived with me going through that. But anyway, and I believe my alcoholism started right there and then. I went through school having a little bouts of stomach problems from time to time, but was able really to maintain. I went to junior high and then on to high school, started dating and met a man who was 11 years older than me. And that's a significant difference when you're in high school. And of course, I always thought anybody that had more than me was better than, you know, is what I wanted. And of course, he had this beautiful horse, and I just happened to be in horses that year. And I believe I married him for that reason. And we went off into happy destiny and built a home and moved in, and I began this new life with this brand new husband and man of what I thought was the perfect little family and the little white picket fence. And two of the most beautiful things that occurred to me during that marriage was my two children. And I was gifted with a beautiful son. And Todd Anthony, he's 34 years old today. I mean, now. And it's March the 12th. And he gave me one of the great events that have come to pass, as Polly so frequently speaks of. He gave me a beautiful grandson this year, and he's 5 months old, and his name is Dakota Cage. And he is the absolute most incredible, most wonderful thing I've ever experienced in my life. And I'm so grateful because I get to experience that. I get to be present for him, and I get to be all the things that I was never when my children were growing up. And I get another opportunity, and it's just such a gift. So I began this marriage and this family, and absolutely knowing nothing about a relationship, nothing about a marriage, nothing about children, I was always restless, irritable, and discontent. I was always waiting and seeking to go out on the weekends, and when we were dating, my husband used to tell me, you know, you just drink too much. If you just wouldn't drink so much. And that began in every weekend occurring event, And my explanation right up to the day I came into the rooms was that I really didn't think I drank any more than anybody else. In my mind, I really thought that I drank no more than anybody else. And in fact, I was drinking a lot more than everybody else. And they weren't blacking out, and I was. And a lot of things were going on. And it became a daily current event with me eventually. But I can just tell you that, you know, it was a soul sickness. You know, I didn't have, I had, now I know it was that big black hole I've heard described in the rooms, and I just had this tremendous emptiness, and I had this depression, and I didn't know why, and I didn't know what it was, and the only way I ever felt good enough, and Michael talks about it when she talks, is I never felt equal to not good enough or not ever as good as. You know, I just never did. And the only time I ever felt even marginally equal to was to drink or to drug. And that gave me that confidence. And it's just kind of amazing how I can look back and see all those things now are so evident. But back then, no one in my family had ever found the rooms. And my family and all my my aunts and uncles and everyone moved down from New York to Columbia and began their life there, and we got together on weekends, and we, you know, they had parties, we cooked out, and it was always, I think everybody, well, everybody in my family had one of these, Uncle Charlie, who inevitably his face would end in the Thanksgiving plate thing, and it was always just one of those events that we, you know, kids would sit around and make fun of that, and we laughed about it, and that was just entertainment. And, you know, we didn't know that that was the disease of alcoholism, and there were always, you know, they'd get together, and then the conversations would get louder and louder, and then there would be screaming and arguing, and then everybody would go home, and then everything would be fine for a week, and then they'd start all over again every weekend, and this was an every weekend occurrence. That's how we grew up, yelling and screaming, and that's how we communicated. My first drunk was probably around 10 or 11 years old. They had one of these weekend affairs at the lake, and they were doing something called Pink Ladies. Don't know if you know what that is, but it's lemonade and a lot of gin and a little bit of cherry juice. And we being a bunch of little kids running around at the lake, and I started emptying out cups, and my cousin started emptying out cups, and before you know, I don't remember exactly what all we were doing, but we blacked out. I don't remember a thing that we did, and I heard a couple of little things, and at that age, it was kind of phenomenal. But those were the kind of things that we did, and that's the background I come from. I moved, eventually I started drinking a lot more than just normal drinking. I started hanging out with people who were smoking pot, and I do talk about drugs because it's a part of my story. And alcohol was definitely my drug of choice, but it got me into avenues where everything else became whatever was there I did. And I started hanging with the people doing those things, and those were the people I wanted to be with because they had what I wanted. And I just made that a way of life. And you can't live in a house and have two kids and try to have this normal little marriage and live a lifestyle like that. So inevitably, I chose that lifestyle. I literally just walked out of the house one day, and I abandoned those kids, and I abandoned that marriage, and everything that whole part of my life stood for, I turned my back on and chose drugs and alcohol. And that's when I went on out there and started doing what I was doing. And I became all those incomprehensible, demoralizing people we read about and hear about. I became that person in search of whatever that is I was looking for to fill that space. And it inevitably took me down to Hilton Head, South Carolina. And I moved there 21 years ago, and I was full on into my alcoholism and hanging with some dangerous people, they had a lot of power, prestige, and a lot of good drugs, and I thought that's where it was, and that's what I wanted to be, and that's where it took me. You know, there were things that were happening around me, and for instance, I was at a house one weekend with some people, and we literally stayed up for about 4 days, and the very next weekend, those same three Colombians that were there were machine gunned down the weekend after. You know, and how close I was, just, you know, right on the edge of all those kinds of things. And I was just living on that edge all the time. And that was total excitement for me. And I loved it. I thrived on it, you know, and how insane. But that's the kind of stuff I did. I carried a .357 Magnum in my purse. And you have to have a big purse for that. That's a big gun. Yeah. It's a heavy gun on top of that. And I mean, I had to go to the grocery store. I had to go. I couldn't leave my home without it. I lived in paranoia all the time. You know, it was just insane. I'm just so grateful that all of that happened in order to qualify me to be here. And I don't know. I tell you, my thoughts and my feelings and my beliefs and all the stuff that. That I came into the rooms with, thank God, qualified me to come here and learn how to live a life today, how to begin to live, because everything I was doing was designed for dying. And everything I stand for today in these rooms is a design for living. And I absolutely love this program. And how I got into the rooms is just another miracle. Like I said, I stumbled into these doors about January 3rd, 1990. There was a gal who had was going down the road in the opposite direction, 278 in Hilton Head, and ran head on into three cars. And I know that she was an alcoholic, and she definitely needed to be here, and she almost died. And I went up to visit her and had to shave her head because she had all these, and she literally had her face peeled off. It was amazing, you know, and that to me was what the disease was all about. You know, I didn't know that this was a disease, but that's what alcoholism was to me. And, you know, and I, a year went by and I didn't see this woman, and finally one day she came to my shop and asked could she work there. And she had these very beautiful, bright, clear eyes, and she had this very happy, serene look on her face. And this was like a year later, and she just needed a place to work, and she couldn't find anybody that would hire her. And I really didn't want to, because I'd run my own little operation, and if you know you're an alcoholic like I'm an alcoholic, you really can't work for anybody else. So you justify it by being self-employed, and that works real well. So you're not accountable to anybody. And anyway, so she came to work for me, and doing her own little thing, and I'd walk in every morning, and I want to tell you, my face would be swollen. I'd be out doing my thing, and I would feel like literally like 40 miles of wolf shit every day. And I'd walk through that door, and I'd look at Vicki, and there she'd be sitting, and she'd just look beautiful and bright-eyed and happy. And it began to be one of the biggest resentments, you know. I come in here, I look at her, she'd smile, and I'd go, and I'd go right in back. And finally one day, and she'd asked me on a couple occasions, if you ever want to go to a meeting, just let me know. And, of course, I wasn't about that. I mean, that was fine for alcoholics like her, but that was not fine for me, because I was not ever going to admit that I was an alcoholic and that I could not... that I did not have the willpower to control my drinking like she couldn't. And all I did was compare. That's all I knew to do. I didn't know how to identify with anything. And so one day, after many, many months of doing the same thing over and over and over again, I walked through the doors, and I had gotten to a point where my drinking was escalating, and I was... it was very quick for me in the very ending of my drinking bout. Was I began to go home every day after work earlier and earlier, and I could no longer go by the local bars and places and drink with friends. Social drinking had stopped for me. I had already stopped the heavy drugs because it was just too inconvenient. Couldn't get my hands on what I wanted when I wanted it, and so drinking was just easier. So I began to drink more and more, and I started leaving work earlier and earlier, and I'd go home and I'd pour myself a big drink, and the glass got larger and larger, and olives became more optional, and you know, it just got down to just plain vodka. It's just amazing to me, it was my first realization that I couldn't stop, that I had this craving, and that I had no more control over the amount. Or that I couldn't do it, that I couldn't quit. And I'd get up the next morning, go to work, and say, I'm just not going to drink today. And at 3 o'clock, I'd go home and do the same thing over and over again. And then I'd wake up at this ungodly hour, somewhere between 12 and 3, and couldn't go back to sleep. And I'd just be in that insane world. You know, now I understand anybody with any sense got up and had another drink, and they felt better. I didn't know that was an option. I just laid there and suffered. And, you know, and I thought I was having this midlife crisis and all this stuff. Well, I was. And so, you know, and I justified that for a while. So I finally had reached a point of total, and I really think that realization was my surrender, you know, as I know it today, was I went to work the next day and I just looked at Vicki, and she looked at me, and there was just this knowing, and there was just this understanding that I couldn't do it anymore, and that it had beat me at its own game, and it was my master, and it had become everything. It had become my friend, and it had taken, you know, it had control over me, and I couldn't stop it. And she said, "Do you want to go to a meeting?" And I said, "Yeah, I can't go today because I look too bad. I got to go tomorrow." So I went, you know, and that's how I thought. So I went home and I tried to clean up my act a little bit so that you guys would think well of me the next day. And I walked in, and that was my first day, and I think I cried for 6 straight months, you know. And it was things like, You know, the first day I went in, I don't remember. The second day I went in, they said, you need to get a sponsor, you need to get a big book, you need to get a home group. And I heard these things, and, you know, and so I said, well, I'll come a couple of times a week. That should be more than enough. And they said, get a big book, so I stole one. And there was a couple other books around. They looked good, too. So I said, you know, more is better. So I got a couple other ones and stole them. But I really wasn't going to get a sponsor. That was taken a little bit too far. So I really didn't. And after about 3 months of that kind of activity, I can assure you what's going to happen. You're going to have to drink again or you know, do something to stand it. So I couldn't drink again because it had beat me to my knees. So I started hanging with the crowds, and you may know, have a few in your rooms, but there's always a couple out there, and you'll know them because when they come to meetings, they always have to wear dark glasses, and it's because they've been smoking pot usually. And you don't want to see them red glazed over eyes. It's a pretty telltale sign. So I started hanging with those guys because they said that nowhere in the big book was marijuana mentioned. That you, it says, you know, it says Alcoholics Anonymous, and that was good enough for me. And so I just teamed right up with those guys and started hanging with them, and, you know, we smoked pot. And so I went on about a 2.5-year sabbatical doing that. Still no sponsors, still hadn't read the big book, and really no real commitment to the program. And I hit my knees again right in these rooms. I had still been, you know, I was coming to a couple of meetings a week, but it was just not doing it for me, and I was reduced to that sense of reasonableness that we hear about in these rooms. And and I was right at that jumping off place. And that was all. I was either to go back out or to kill myself, you know. And that's really where it takes you. I was asked to be a hostess for this woman who was coming to speak in Hilton Head. And the first time she came, I had just about had it with this AA stuff. Actually, right. Let me back up just a little bit. Michael had come down to speak at the Midwinter Conference, and this is where my head was at. I looked at the brochure, and it had the men's names on it, you know, and I saw all men's names on it, and I said, I've had it. You know, is all they have in these rooms is just a bunch of old farts sharing their experience, strength, and hope. I don't want to go anymore. Aren't there any sober women out there, you know? And finally, someone got tired of hearing me moan and groan about it. And they threw me this tape, and it was Michael's tape, and I listened to it, and that was my first point of identification. I mean, she talked about being poor, and she talked about the things in her childhood and not being good enough and not equal to and not good as. And all of those things for the first time, and I believe that was one of my first spiritual awakenings in these rooms. You know, I was listening to that tape, and I listened to it over and over and over again. And it began to give me a little bit of hope. And I was asked, would I be her hostess when she came down? Because she was going to come back in a couple months to speak. I didn't go to that conference, by the way. I missed out. But I went to the other one. Now, no one had ever given me any instructions on how to be a hostess. They just asked me if I'd be a hostess, and I said, yeah. I always said, yeah, to everything, just about. And so I didn't call her, and I didn't go see her, and I didn't do anything. I met her the night she was to speak. And they asked me to introduce her, and so I got a couple of minutes with her right before she gave her talk, and I just idolized this woman, and I know then I was beginning to see things and hear things and understand things that I had never felt or knew before. You know, I know when I got here, I guess the best way I can describe it is when I got here, I don't feel like I could see and I could hear and I could talk. And I began to see things and hear things and began to listen and began to understand things when I began to hear that tape. And I think I had to go to that point of desperation to get there. And as I began to hear Michael talk and share her story, the light started to go on just a little bit, just that little flicker of faith in there that began to be, you know, began to come alive again. And she sat with me after she talked, and she asked me if I had a sponsor, and I told her I'd been thinking about it, and I was given a lot of consideration. And And that's probably not a good thing to tell anybody like Polly or Michael, because then they're on you, boy. It's like white on rice. And she told me at least 1,500 more times that night that I needed a sponsor. Gave me a couple of cards. And I really just didn't think that it was going to be even a possibility because she lived so far away. Well, she agreed. And I tell you, I was not just catapulted into another dimension. Boy, I was skyrocketed out there. And I've been in warp speed ever since. It's been the absolute best thing I've ever done. And it was all by just... I was just willing. And I don't get willing until my head is against the wall. And that's what happened for me. And I just want to tell you, it's been the most incredible journey. I wouldn't trade one day of what I have for all the years of what I thought I had out there. And it's by far the most beautiful thing I've ever imagined. I couldn't even imagine this. I can't even go there with you. One thing for sure, I heard this at a meeting. Almost everything I'm going to tell you here is that sounds half good is something I heard from somebody else out there. And this describes me as my living condition had deteriorated faster than I could lower my standards. And it so described me. So described me. I mean, I love that. And and Michael just became, you know, my higher power. She became someone that I respected, and I began to trust her just enough that I could listen to some of the things she was telling me. And I also was still going through that depression. I was still going through a lot of stuff that was beginning to gargle up in this muck of a brain of mine, in this sick soul I'd been living with for so long. And she began the process, you know, very slowly. But she told me right there and then that you don't have to do any of this alone, that she would be there for me and she'd walk with me hand in hand through this whole process. And no one had ever told me that. And I began to read the big book. I read the first 164 pages like she suggested. And that was the first time I'd ever done that. And it was just amazing. And when I got through with that, we began the step process. Now, in all fairness, I need to back up just a little bit. There was a gentleman who had come down from Boston who was speaking in our rooms, and my home group is the Signs Group, 9 o'clock group on Hilton Head. It meets Monday through Friday, and I'm a member of good standing there. And I love that meeting. It's my favorite meeting, and I invite all of you, if you're down there, to please come to that meeting. That's where I've met a lot of my sponsees, and they're from all over the country, and it's just been a wonderful place. Anyway, they have some good, solid sobriety there, and I'm very proud of my home group. And if you're not proud of your home group, stay where you are. Don't go mess up somebody else's, for God's sake. There was a man by the name of Dick who came down from Boston, and he became known around our parts as the fourth-step Nazi. And I'd never heard of a fourth-step sponsor or fourth-step Nazi to back that up. And he began working with some people, and I began to see an amazing transformation occur with these people. And it was nothing more than them going through this step process. I'm sure that this stuff was being discussed at my group meetings and at my home meetings and any meetings I went to, but I just wasn't hearing them. But I began to hear Dick, and I'd ask him to, this was right before I'd met Michael, and I began to, one day, you know, I began to kind of casually speak with Dick. I didn't want to get too friendly because fear I'd have to do something. And I was walking in the kitchen to get some coffee, and out of my mouth came these words: "Would you become my four-step sponsor?" Now, I didn't get up that morning thinking I was going to be doing anything about anything that day. I didn't have that on my agenda. And I know that that wasn't me. That was literally God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. Dick knew me, and he knew me well enough to get me right after the meeting, and we went to my shop and we locked the front door, and he talked to me about a few things that I hadn't heard before. And he took me through a few pages in the big book, and he read a couple of excerpts in there, and we're going to say that third step prayer. And he said, "You see that door right there? When we say this third step prayer, you're going to walk through that door and you're never going to come back the same person that goes through there." And I went, yeah, yeah, yeah. And so, you know, I don't know what was driving me to do this, but yet I could no longer say no. And so we did that, and he said, I want you to go home tonight, and I want you to get out your pen and your paper, and I want you to make a list of all your resentments of people, places, and things. And I know I'm jumping around a little bit. I hope you guys can keep up with me. But anyway, I went home that night, and I had already quit smoking pot because it really simply was no longer working for me. And I don't know if that's ever happened to any of you, but it just quit working. And I went home and I rolled a joint and I looked at the step work. And I held the joint in this hand and the pen and paper in this hand. It was just, it was going back and forth. And I looked at this was no longer working. Why not give this a chance? And so I went outside. I knelt in my backyard and I said that third step prayer. I sat down. And I took the pen and I put it to paper, and the next thing I know, I began to do writing. And it was like an automatic type of writing. You may have heard of this before. It was really kind of a weird experience. And before I could, the next thing I knew, I had over 100 names on my list. And I looked at my watch, and only about 20 minutes had gone by, and I didn't even remember writing these names. And that was really another spiritual experience happening for me. And I got that done. Well, Dick had to go back to Boston that very next day, and he was going to come back, but something interfered with him coming back, and that's when I met Michael. So I'd been sitting on this stuff and had never done anything with it. And when I met Michael, she began the process. I read the book again, 164 pages. She has everybody do that. It's a good thing. And she began the process of telling me what to do with those names. And from that list came everything else. And, you know, I know that step one, you know, that I was always powerless over alcohol. And my life had always been unmanageable. And that was revealed to me. And I have a belief in a higher power. I just didn't have a belief in a God as I had understood him and grew. I'd grown up in, I'm a recovering Catholic, by the way. And I went to parochial school for about 6 years. And, you know, and that God simply didn't work for me anymore. And I had a resentment against God. And so I believed in a higher power. I believed in a spirit of the universe. And Native American Indian spiritual belief works for me. And that's my belief today. And that is a God of my understanding. And my God of my understanding is all-encompassing today. And so I didn't have a problem with step two. I had a problem with the part that says restore me to sanity, because I didn't think I was insane to start with. So that was a new revelation to me. But my sponsor pointed out to me that what became my power for a while too was my sponsor. And today, that's still a very empowering aspect of my sobriety. If you have a sponsor and you don't want what she has, you need to find one that you do, because that's part of the beauty of this journey. And it's helped me so much to. I look up to this woman and I love this woman. What she's done for me is just amazing. And Polly is the same way. So I began that process. When it came to step three, I'd taken step three with Dick, but I did it again with Michael. And I really believe that that's when my recovery began. And it's kind of like making a decision. You know, I made a lot of decisions, but until you take the actions, nothing really changes. And so, you know, I made that searching and fearless inventory. And it talks about fearless inventory, not fearful inventory. And that had to be pointed out to me, because everything was so fear-based for me. And when I got to step five, you know, one of the first things, the first names on my list was my daughter. Now, I'd made a list of persons I had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. And one of the first ones on my list was my daughter. My daughter had died in a car accident with me a little over 22 years ago. She was 9, and as a direct result of my alcoholism, we were involved in a car accident, and she died in that accident with me. And that was the first recollection, and it was the first time that I became aware that that was just not an accident. I'd been living in that denial and drinking over it and drugging over it for all those years. And why wouldn't you? To live with that, you have to. You can't live in your skin and not do something to alter that, you know. And I covered that up in denial, and I rationalized it and justified it and all that stuff for a long time. And when I got to step 8, I was at step 5 and I made that list and did 6 and 7 with my sponsor. And because my sponsor didn't trust me to go home, and when I did step 5 with her, she didn't trust me to go home and do 6 and 7 by myself. And I follow that through today too, because I think if you do, you allow people to go home and they have too much time on their hands. I believe in going steps 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. That way you got them on the beam and they're there and they can get right through it. I don't believe in hanging on to this stuff and staying in it. I believe in getting through it as quickly as possible, and that's how I do it. But anyway, we made that list of persons I had harmed, and when Michael pointed out to me that I was responsible and accountable for my daughter's death, that was a real hard thing for me to take a look at. I never admitted that I, was responsible. How could I? And to take a look at that, and I'd already committed to go through this process, and Michael assured me that I could go through this and that she would help me. And she said, "You're just going to have to write a letter, and we'll take it to the grave, and we'll read that letter." And I agreed to do that. And I went down to Edistota to visit with Michael and write this letter. And I had gotten to a point, and I'll tell you, right after that, I became very depressed and suicidal. I didn't want to drink again. Drinking wasn't an option. I just wanted to die. And that's where it took me. And why wouldn't it with something like that? How do you live with yourself? You don't. And so I went down there, and Michael said, "We're going to write this letter." And we began the process. And the next morning, we were going to go find the grave. I had never been there. I didn't know where it was. So we made plans to go to Columbia and find the cemetery and find the grave and take some flowers and to have communion with my daughter and to read this letter of amends and the remorse and the guilt and the shame, the paralyzing pain that filled every fiber of my body. It was a hard thing. I see those scars every day as a result of that accident. I too died in that accident, and it was a long road of recovery physically. And so I never did get to the cemetery. I never did experience any of that. So when I got there, I didn't know where it was. So Michael and I spent a couple hours actually finding it. And it was extremely, extremely hot. And I'm talking around 106, 108 degrees the day we got there that morning. And I found where it was, and Michael wasn't feeling too good. She'd had some sinus surgery, and I kept the air conditioning running in the car because she was very weak and wasn't feeling that good. But I was just crazy, and she just intuitively knew what to do, and we got there, and I wanted to bury my 4-year chip at the time there. I took some flowers and some other little things I wanted to bury. And I began to read this letter, and I'd like to read it to you. "Dearest Tina, I'm so proud to tell you but you probably already know that I've been sober in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm sorry it took so long to take these actions, and I want to make amends for my actions as an irresponsible, undependable, and absent mother. I'm responsible for your death, and I'm eternally sorry. And I love you with all my heart, and I promise you I will use this tragedy to help others and hopefully prevent other such tragedies like this from happening. I embrace you and I love you, Mom. And as I began to read this letter, and as hot as it was that day, Michael and I were standing there. She had her arms around me, holding me up. There was an incredible wind engulfed us. There was no wind stirring this day. There were no clouds, and we were standing close to a tree. And this incredible wind began to engulf us as I read the letter. And right above me, I looked up, and there was an eagle circling over us as I read this letter. And, you know, I just got this overwhelming sense of my daughter and the sense of God's presence. And I know that it was just a huge spiritual experience I was right in the middle of. And I looked at Michael, and our hair was just like standing straight back. And we were no longer hot. We were immediately cool. And if there was a light presence. And it was just a huge spiritual experience. And I felt forgiveness. And, you know, had I not done that, had I not been willing to trust one other person just ever so much to superimpose over the fear and all of the darkness and that soul sickness I suffered from. I trusted Michael just enough to get me over all of that stuff to believe in one other person and to get into that through her, to have this experience. It's been the most incredible thing of my life. And I want to share something with you that is just probably one of the greatest events of my sobriety, and that's Trish. And she wrote the most beautiful poem about her daughter, who also died in a car accident with her, Amanda. And we've been talking for 5 years on the phone, and up until yesterday, we'd never met face-to-face. And, you know, only another alcoholic can understand or identify with another alcoholic. Only another mother that's been through what we've been through can identify and understand the pain that we go through on a daily basis. And there are certain times when we just simply have to talk to each other to get through what we have to go through. And that's one of the gifts of this program. And I got the Trish and I started talking, and she wrote this poem for her daughter and my daughter, and I'd like to read this. And I read this every time I'm asked to share my story. And it's the most beautiful poem I've ever seen, and I love this poem, and it's so close to my heart and my soul, as well as Trish. And I feel and have felt the presence of both our daughters this whole weekend. And it's called Trish's Poem, in memory of our daughters and our sobriety. There's a little 9-year-old girl up in the sky, and she holds my baby between her legs on a swing of silver lace clouds. Her arms clasp around her waist so she won't slip. My baby's downy hair tickles her nose, but she keeps on singing sweet lullabies and tells her stories of ladybugs and fireflies. She tells her what it's like to go to school, something my baby never got to do. She tells her she wasn't sure if Santa Claus was real. My baby seems to know what she means as she giggles and squeals. Then she spoke of her mother with the warmest sound, and the baby of mine, she looked around, and their eyes met, and they knew the same disease had brought them there. An illness so ugly, they didn't care that their mothers loved them so dearly and would have died in their place. How they wished and prayed to see their faces just one more time, to smell their smell, to let them know that now they were well and the disease had retreated after quite a fight. One day at a time, they win this war. The little girl whispered into my baby's ears as they swung even higher into the clouds. I know our mothers didn't want it this way, and I hope they know we have each other and that it's okay. You know, taking those actions, step 4 through 9, was the hardest thing I've ever done, but it was the best thing I've ever done. And I've come to believe in a power that I can't touch and I can't feel or see, and a power so great that can take the worst thing I've ever done and allow me to use it today as a tool so that it might prevent other kids from dying out there. And I came here with shame and guilt and remorse, and what I found here in Alcoholics Anonymous was acceptance and forgiveness and unconditional love. And that forgiveness came as I took those actions in step 4 through 9. And I've come to know a new freedom and a new happiness. And today the best part of that is I know usefulness. And I want to thank you for my sobriety today. God bless. Thanks for letting me share.